From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The rapidly evolving realignment that appears to be developing in Asia continued to unfold Tuesday as the U.S. and South Korea agreed to suspend the large-scale military exercises originally set for August following the recent summit between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump. We begin with this report from RT's Samira Khan.
Well, this comes just a week after the historic summit that took place last week in Singapore, which Trump went back and forth on. There was some confusion whether or not it would actually take place. But just after the summit, Trump promised to cut back military exercises with South Korea, saying that the costs of war games are too high. But given their tense history, it's interesting to witness how dramatically Trump has shifted in terms of his attitude towards Kim in such a short period of time.
Best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago.
He's a very talented man. I also learned that he loves his country very much.
The White House also said that the drills would continue to remain a pause so long as the North Koreans continue to act in good faith. So it seems that there are no losers in this situation, especially considering that Trump is indeed keeping his word. Well, at least for now. So we'll just have to see what happens.
Meanwhile, Japan voiced concerns over the suspended war games as Press TV's Frank Smith reports from Seoul, South Korea.
U.S. President Donald Trump has said the United States agreed to suspend its joint military exercises with South Korea as long as North Korea negotiates sincerely on its denuclearization. After some confusion among U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, the White House confirmed the arrangement after the drill's suspension was agreed with Seoul.
Those conversations are ongoing, and at this point, as long as the North Koreans continue to act in good faith, as we saw in Singapore, then we expect those things to be on pause at this point.
Japan in particular appears concerned the U.S. conceded too much in suspending the war games, hardly surprising given the Shinzo Abe government's desire to revise Tokyo's pacifist constitution.
It's our understanding that the U.S.-South Korean drills, like the U.S.-Japanese drills, or the U.S.-Japan-South Korean security and defense cooperation, are the important pillars of peace and stability in the region.
The suspension of the drills marks perhaps a cosmetic concession, which does not involve other significant potential non-aggression incentives, such as signing a peace treaty or withdrawing at least some of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea.
Trump has not articulated what exactly U.S. will offer to North Korea in exchange for denuclearization. I think this is also one area that has been little explored in the media outlets, because the media outlets have been focusing on North Korea's denuclearization.
North Korea and South Korea continue developing cooperation on the heels of their leadership summit on April 27th. Monday, the two sides agreed to field a joint team for the Asian Games in Indonesia this August, and will Friday meet over restarting the reunions of families separated during the 1950-53 Korean War.
The suspension of joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated for August does serve to draw down the tension the Korean Peninsula experienced last year with the war of words between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Still, all sides agree it's only the beginning, both in terms of North Korea's denuclearization, but also concerning the security guarantees Washington has vowed to provide Pyongyang in return. Frank Smith, Press TV, Seoul.
Also Tuesday, Kim Jong-un arrived in Beijing for his third meeting with China's President Xi Jinping of late. Jessica Stone, reporting for China's Global TV Network, says Beijing is a key player in the ongoing processes sweeping the region.
Kim Jong-un's third trip to China since March comes as Beijing takes steps to strengthen its role as mediator between Pyongyang and Washington. China, of course, claims compelling security and economic security reasons to be heavily involved in the region. President Xi Jinping and his wife Peng Liyuan welcomed Kim Jong-un and his wife Ri Sol-ju to the Great Hall of the People. She and Kim also inspected an honor guard together. According to Chinese domestic media reports, Kim thanked Xi for his support, telling him he, quote, hopes to work with China and other concerned parties to promote and establish a solid, long-lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. Kim was also expected to brief Xi on his talks with U.S. President Donald Trump in Singapore last week. Xi told Kim he hopes Pyongyang and Washington can carry out the results of their historic summit. Seoul welcomed the meeting.
The governments of South Korea and China share the same strategic goal of completely denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Also, our government hopes China will play a constructive role in resolving this problem. We hope Chairman Kim Jong-un's visit will contribute to that.
On Monday, Seoul and Washington announced they are suspending plans for their annual August military drills. Last week, President Trump appeared to surprise some in the region by announcing he was willing to suspend the exercises as long as Kim is, quote, engaging in good faith negotiations on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. A spokesperson for the ROK Defense Ministry said regional defense remains a priority and Pyongyang will be expected to live up to its recent commitments.
Regarding South Korea-U.S. joint defense, both countries are preparing diligently, without any trouble, and will continue to do so. Also, regarding the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, we are expecting corresponding measures as we decided to suspend joint drills.
Last year, more than 17,000 Americans and more than 50,000 South Koreans participated in the August military drills. As for now, these are the only ones suspended, though that could be revisited in the future. Jessica Stone, CGTN, Washington.
Brian Becker is the executive director of the Answer Coalition and also the host of a daily radio program on Radio Sputnik based in Washington. He was in Singapore for the Korea-U.S. summit, and he spoke with CGTN's Elena Reyes about the situation on the Korean Peninsula.
What we're witnessing now in Korea, I think, is the initiative from North Korea, the initiative from South Korea, and the support from the People's Republic of China. That's what's really driven this new dynamic. That's what's created a new context. Donald Trump has joined this context. The decision by Washington to cancel these clearly provocative war games in August was a very, very positive step. But I think the DPRK, South Korea, and China are really actually driving the process.
And are you surprised that all of this has sort of come together? I mean, 6 months ago, this was a different conversation.
It was a different conversation. The bluster, the bluff, the threats, fire and fury, little rocket man, we're going to annihilate the DPRK, all of that kind of commentary, that bellicose rhetoric from Donald Trump and from others in the American administration. It's such a profound shift. It's almost a breathtaking change. But even back then, I personally felt that there was a great possibility. The DPRK had done what it thought it needed to do to guarantee its own security, a nuclear credible threat, a missile technology with a long-range capacity. And they said back in January 1st, 2018, we are ready now to reach out to the South. And the South reciprocated right away. The North and the South created this momentum. You can remember at the Olympic Games, Mike Pence there with his arms folded, looking all icy when the two Koreas came in together and there was so much optimism. Trump had to change that policy. The peace train was leaving the station and America wasn't on it.
What's going on behind the scenes now in Beijing? We understand that Kim Jong-un is briefing President Xi on the Singapore summit. What is the next step? What should we be looking for next?
Well, I think the next step has to be looked at from the point of view of what Trump and Kim Jong-un actually signed. The declaration and the order of the declaration is extremely important. Point number one was not denuclearization. Point number one was a new policy, a new relationship between the U.S. and the DPRK. Two, a permanent mechanism so that war would not come again to the Korean Peninsula. And then number three was denuclearization. Now, we know North Korea has taken unilateral steps, including a moratorium on its missile technology tests and nuclear tests, the blowing up of its own nuclear test site. What comes next now is a genuine reciprocation from the United States. The cancellation of the war games is a palpable next step. So that's the whole approach of DPRK and, I believe, China, step by step, synchronized, reciprocal. So I think we have a lot of momentum right now.
And are you encouraged by seeing Kim Jong-un traveling so much outside of the country in recent months? China three times, to Singapore, to the DMZ, who knows where else next?
Yeah, he's come to China three times. He's been invited to go to Moscow. Donald Trump has invited him, and he's accepted to come to the White House. As you mentioned, he was in Singapore last week at the summit. This shows that the DPRK has, in fact, already emerged from its isolated position. They are in a very much stronger position diplomatically. They're taking advantage of that to make palpable next step gains for the peace process. I think it's extremely positive.
Here in the U.S., the reaction to the developing situation in Korea seems stuck within the framework of partisan politics, or, more specifically, whether one loves or hates President Donald Trump. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford discussed this and some of the history of U.S.-Korean relations with Professor Tony Montero.
First of all, on the side of Trump, who was both rational and irrational at the same time, Trump, I believe, crystallizes what has been inevitable for at least a decade and a half, if not more, that of the processes of imperial retreat, the attempt to be the single superpower, the military hegemon in the world, was bankrupting the U.S. And this is obviously clearly reflected in the collapse of the U.S. infrastructure, by which I include not just bridges and roads and buildings, but also the ruin of the American people through lack of health care, through lack of education, through lack of the possibility of a decent life. So the American people as a whole, including the African-American people, had become extremely disenchanted with the direction of the U.S. empire and of the U.S. ruling elite. And in a lot of ways, as we've discussed before, it is that discontent that led to the 2016 victory of Donald Trump. There's no other way to look at it. So there is that tendency, that process of imperial retreat, unacknowledged in the media, unacknowledged by most politicians who want us to believe that the United States is still the great superpower. But imperial retreat was inevitable, and a regroupment and a reorientation of the relationships of the United States, not just to the world in general, but really to its principal allies like the European Union. But that having been said, the brilliance of the leadership of North Korea was to seize the moment. Now, of course, that capacity to seize the moment required that the North Korean state arrive at a new level of military and technological capacity to defend the state, the Korean state, and hence the Korean nation, which they have. And that was spectacular. It was a spectacular political, technological, military feat to have developed the missiles and the hydrogen explosive capacities that they have, in spite of every attempt by the United States to intimidate them, to use cyber warfare, to undermine their tests and so on. They reached that level. And once that had been reached, then they were able to negotiate with, first of all, the Asian or Northeast Asian nations, in particular, China and South Korea. And to negotiate not from a position of strength, but from a position of equality. And thence the fact that the president of South Korea was a mediator, a go-between to make possible what the leadership of North Korea proposed, a meeting with the president of the United States and the beginning of processes towards a detente, an end to the Korean War, the reunification in one another form of North and South Korea, and the withdrawal of U.S. military forces. I think, and this is a spectacular achievement, all of those things are pretty close to being realized. If you read the Singapore Declaration or document, it in effect says that North Korea and the United States want relationships of what used to be called peaceful coexistence. Trump said that he is for the end of these military exercises, which he said are and have been provocative, and ultimately the withdrawal of the 30,000 U.S. troops, and of course all of these weapon systems and aircraft carriers and so on from the waters around the Korean Peninsula and in South Korea. I would finally say that what we have seen is the emergence on the world scene of a new type of leadership coming out of North Korea, a small nation, and most of the nations of the world are relatively small in terms of population, a small nation, a united people, a committed leadership were able to stand up for its right to self-determination in the face of threats and belligerency coming from the most powerful military empire in human history.
You described the South Korean president as a mediator, but I think maybe he was much more of an initiator. The two Korean leaders met certainly before the meeting with Trump and continued their dialogue even in the face of what seemed to be real U.S. opposition to them getting together. Mm-hmm. After all, that is the whole purpose, isn't it? To divide the Koreans.
Right. Yes, but I would still stick to my characterization. The principal agent of these processes is the North Korean leadership. If you recall, it was the North Korean government and Kim Jong-un that first floated the idea of North Korea being a part of the Olympics in South Korea. And from there, a number of other moves followed, including the fact that the sister and I think the president of North Korea attended the Olympics, and then other negotiations with the government of South Korea leading to, for the first time, a leader and a president of North Korea crossing the border into South Korea, and this great celebration of the possibility of reuniting the Korean Peninsula. I mean, this was so spectacular that 85% of the South Koreans look upon Kim Jong-un positively. So it's with that, and I agree with you, that the initiating of these processes began between the Koreans. And it is that which wisely Trump, if not his administration, realized that something new was happening, that inevitably the Korean people, North and South, would reject the whole scheme of U.S. military occupation and these exercises. I think that's what happened. And I think the North Korean leadership is principally the major factor in all of this.
And because this is in large part an agreement between Koreans, the development of these relationships, North and South, is something that the United States cannot effectively prohibit or inhibit.
That's right. And see, the other thing about it is that once the Koreans had reached what is in effect a detente and an agreement to end the Korean War, and to come to some principles of unity, then the government in China responds to this, invites Kim Jong-un twice to Beijing for talks, which are friendly, which establish that if a detente is reached between the Koreans and then the United States, that the Chinese government would withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. And then later, the foreign minister of Russia shows up in North Korea for talks with the leadership there, and then invites Kim Jong-un for a state visit to Russia. And then on top of that, the president of Syria, Assad, says that he intends to make a state visit to North Korea. I mean, what we are seeing is an unleashing of processes of peace and self-determination, the likes of which we have not seen in over 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I would predict that all roads from Africa and Asia and maybe even Europe now lead, and also South America now lead to North Korea. I think the leadership there will be a model for many nations in the world and demonstrates how both to pursue socialist construction, to consolidate state power, and at the same time to develop the technology necessary to defend the state.
Russia and China did participate in sanctions against North Korea. Russia and China have participated in sanctions against Iran, even though Iran is now or will soon be a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement. And even though these sanctioning parties have been sanctioning Russia, are we going to soon see an end to Russia and China's cooperation with these sanctioning regimes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in terms of the sanctioning regimes against Iran and North Korea, they're done. And the United States, if it continues sanctions or new sanctions, as Trump is talking about against Iran, they will be isolated. And certainly the world, including the Trump administration, has stated that they are prepared to withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. But I think it raises still some questions about how Russia and especially China operated over the last 35 years on the world stage. It was like they were allowed to come into the World Trade Organization, which is this global finance capital run organization with rules of operation that favor multinational corporations and banks and so on. Once they were in there, then they began to play by the rules of the West, including in the UN Security Council, to position themselves against nations who develop weapons merely to defend themselves. And so the Russians and the Chinese, and especially the Chinese, were playing this 19th century and 20th century great power game, that what was in the interest of China would be pursued. And there was no sense of international solidarity. That is, of course, not new in China. Even after the revolution, they were profoundly nationalistic and Chinese-centric. And so they remained so. Hopefully, there might be some changes. The Russians, of course, sanctions against North Korea for its developing nuclear weapons, but at the same time inviting Netanyahu as a state visitor on the National Day celebrating the end of World War II. Friendship with Israel, but in this period that we're talking about, hostility in favor of Western interests against North Korea and Iran. I think that might be ending. It does not solve all the problems because the leaderships in Russia and China are divided on any number of issues, including their role in the world, how, if at all, they will fight for world peace. But more than that, Will China eventually return to the path of socialist construction? And will Russia adopt policies that do not favor oligarchs and rich people and billionaires in Russia, but are more predisposed to a working class, even a social democratic policy that will uplift the living standards of their own people?
Certainly half the Republicans don't sincerely support this peace initiative, and the Democrats are outright hostile. Is there only Trump standing behind this on the U.S. scene?
No. Again, I go back to the inevitability of imperialist retreat. U.S. imperialism had overreached and was bankrupting itself and the nation to support its military empire. Retreat was inevitable. They weren't going to announce it and say, oh, we're in imperial retreat. But if you look at much that's going on in the world, one sees this retreat. Now, TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which comes out of the Obama administration, to me represented, in a very ironic way, the sense that the military empire had to retreat and take second or backseat to new economic relationships in East Asia. But, you know, again, and here we're just speculating, I think we're looking at what was inevitable for Republicans and Democrats. The conflict was over how to do it, when to do it, and so on. Of course, you get hardliners that say we never can retreat. And then you get people who are hardliners in public, but in private recognize that the United States' role in the world had to change, or else both parties would face on a grander scale what happened in 2016, which again was the result of a legitimation crisis that masses of people have turned against the political establishment, literally the regime itself. And without a new kind of, you could call it a new deal, a social democratic set of policies to do something for the increasingly impoverished American population. And what I saw as very important in 2016, and it's not just a single line, it's contradictory, is that a great part of, if not the majority, of white Americans are distancing themselves from the neoliberal regime, which, and the policies which have impoverished them.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.